Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
We welcome on Dr. Tom Russo. He is Chief of Infectious Diseases at the Jacobs School of Medicine, talking about, well, the upcoming holiday. Dr. Russo, thanks for joining us. You know, this is kind of the period of time we've been given a big warning about when it comes to the spread of the virus, with a lot of gatherings expected over the holidays. What are you expecting to see over the next 2 to 3 weeks?
Well, Brian, I think we're looking at really more than a 2 to 3 week period. We're talking about sort of the combination of Thanksgiving, the religious holidays, then January 1st celebration of the New Year. So we have a series of holidays and events coming up that traditionally people have gathered and celebrated together, often involving food and drink indoors. And we know that scenario is a prime setting for continued spread of the new coronavirus. So we had a bad month. We're still sort of not in a great spot. We maybe sort of settled just a whiff. But I'm quite concerned that, the reversal that I was hoping for is going to be lost with Thanksgiving and the subsequent holidays. I'm hoping for the best, but unfortunately I've got a feeling what I've seen with all this travel that that's not going to be the case.
You know, and what we're seeing right now locally and around the country, Dr. Fauci this morning called it a surge upon a surge. Hospitalization rates have never been higher than they are right now in Erie County. What is your best advice for someone who is still planning to attend some kind of a gathering tomorrow?
Well, it depends on how well they were prepared. So if you're going to mix household or cross social bubbles, the safest way to do that is if all the individuals involved undergo a rigorous quarantine, a self-quarantine for 14 days, and at the end of that quarantine, get a test for the new coronavirus. And if it's negative, then they could feel, with a relative degree, you can never get that risk down to zero, that it's probably then safe for those individuals to sort of cross the social bubble. Unfortunately, the timing to do that is past. And it's also contingent upon, after you do the quarantine, you could travel safely from place A to B. And obviously, and that involves plane, train, bus, et cetera, then that's going to involve a certain amount of risk. What a lot of people are doing, say, I'm just going to go out, I'm going to get a test, and if I'm negative, I'm good. If you get a test and positive, actually, that has a lot of value. That means that you shouldn't get together with those other individuals. But if it's negative and it's not at the end of a quarantine period, you could still have been exposed and incubating and negative the day of the test and then show up for the festivities, be infectious, and spread the virus to others. And so this is going to be a risky situation we're facing unless you've decided just to celebrate Thanksgiving within your own household or within your own social bubble. Otherwise, the risk in most circumstances could be significant.
You know, we've been talking a lot about testing today and some of the questions people have when it comes to testing. How much is it going to cost? Where can I get the free test? Where might it cost me money? There was confusion yesterday with Rite Aid saying they were ending their no-cost testing and then, you know, quickly after saying, well, no, now we're expanding no-cost testing. Is it surprising to you, or am I just, you know, too pie in the sky thinking of a lot of these things that, you know, by this point, we've had, you know, so many months to prepare. Should we not have some sort of easy to take, maybe even take at home test that is already widely available for people to, you know, be able to gauge their risk that way and have a better idea on if they are carrying COVID?
Yeah, Brian, we've talked about this several times, and both of us have been desperately waiting for sort of the home pregnancy equivalent test, right, where it's inexpensive, costs maybe $1 to $5. You could do it at home yourself, and you could test yourself every day, daily testing is by far the most effective means, as opposed to that single point of time, which sometimes you have to wait days for the result. And so if you're positive, loses lots of public health value. Now, companies have been working on this, and we've just had one so far that's been approved on an emergency use authorization by the FDA, accompanied by Lucira. But it's not going to be widely available this spring. It's expensive. It's $50. It still requires a doctor's prescription. So we're not there yet. This is the solution, or at least part of the solution, from a testing point of view, that we'd desperately like to have. I remain hopeful. Hopefully it'll become available soon, but we're just not there yet, unfortunately.
Why not? Where did we either go wrong, or was it always unrealistic to expect that by now?
It's not unrealistic, and so these rapid tests could be based on detection of the nucleic acid of the virus, but usually they're based on detecting what we call antigen, or protein parts of the virus. The technology is out there. It's not quite clear to me why this hasn't been more widely available at a lower cost. I think it will be. I just don't have an explanation for you why it's taking as long as it has at this point.
You know, Dr. Russo, I heard this morning the CDC is considering shortening the quarantine period if someone is exposed to a person who's COVID positive, reducing it from 14 days to either 7 to 10 days. Why would they do that right now?
Yeah, I have a little bit of mixed feelings about that, Susan. I could see 14 to 12 days. We know that at least people that are going to become symptomatic, 97% will be symptomatic by 12 days. If you drop it down to the 7-day mark, there's going to be a significant number of individuals that will still develop symptoms after that. So I haven't seen their line of reasoning and the rationale for this as of yet. I'd like to see that, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
We've had, you know, a lot of positive news on vaccine development over the last several weeks. Since we've last talked to you, I believe the Oxford vaccine is kind of taking that next step forward, maybe not as far along as some of the others, the Pfizer and Moderna that we've heard so much about. But the Oxford vaccine is a little bit different. I'm wondering if you might be able to, in layman's terms, so to speak, kind of explain the difference between what Pfizer and Moderna are doing and what the Oxford vaccine is, and if we should at all be aware of it, concerned about it, or paying attention, or is, you know, a vaccine and it doesn't matter to us?
Well, a vaccine is not a vaccine, and they could, you know, how well they work and potential side effects could vary, and that's why we do these large trials to sort that out. In short, the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, it targets the same piece of the virus, the spike protein. That's what all our first phase vaccines are targeting at this point. The way it does it is slightly different. The code or message for that spike protein for us to develop antibodies against this is in the form of DNA that's delivered in a viral vector, an adenovirus viral vector. That vector, once it gets into the cells, cannot replicate. It sort of releases its payload, the code, and then the protein is made and the body develops antibodies against it. By contrast, the RNA vaccines that we've heard about from Moderna and Pfizer, it's RNA that's delivered into the cell, which subsequently then gets made into the protein. So there's some subtle differences here. The devil is in the details. At the end of the day, they may be equally efficacious and safe, or one may prove to be better, given the host, the ethnic background, the age of the individual as well. And that's why it's nice to have multiple lines in the water that have been broadly tested against, you know, large populations. So it may be at the end of the day that some of these are better for some groups than others, or it may be that they all work equally well. But having a choice and options in the long run is going to be beneficial. And, of course, there's some significant issues here with cost and supply chain. The new vaccine from Oxford is a fridge vaccine. It's going to be cheaper to make, and it's going to be easier to distribute. So that's going to work very well in countries that are not going to be able to meet these challenging logistical needs of, you know, minus 70 temperatures for the RNA vaccine.
Right. And now it's a double dose vaccine for all of them. But if you start out getting the Oxford vaccine, that second dose can't be the Moderna or Pfizer one, right?
Yeah, we don't want to cross the beams here at this point, because obviously in a given trial, it's going to be based on a certain vaccine with a certain regimen. And so that's how it's going to go at this point. You know, with time, we may learn that, you know, getting dose A of one and then a different dose another may even work better. But we really need data and trials and solid scientific evidence to ascertain that that would be efficacious even better. So, yes, at this point, once you start with the vaccine, if it's a multi-dose vaccine, you would end with that vaccine.
All right, now is the time for you to tell me how crazy I am. You know, I love to talk about having people in the Bills stadium. And we're being realistic. It doesn't look like the governor is going to allow that to happen anytime in the future. But, Dr. Russo, January 10th, that's the day, you know, around there, we could be looking at a Bills playoff game. And my thinking is, by then, could we have a few thousand, maybe even just 1,000, vaccinated local healthcare workers in the stands for that game by that time in January? Is that too optimistic?
Well, first, Brian, if they don't make the playoffs, you jinx them and we're all going to hold you responsible.
I'm not even thinking about that now.
We're all going to remember this moment right now. You know, unfortunately, with the timing as such, the vaccine we think might be available mid-December. And remember, it's a two-shot vaccine with either 3 or 4 weeks apart, and then maximum protection is probably 2 weeks after that. So I think that with your scenario, maybe we should look for beyond the first round of the playoffs.
I like what you're saying, but, you know, don't jinx it, Dr. Russo. What are you doing? all right. Hey, we appreciate the time and hope you have a great holiday.
Come this one.
All right. Dr. Russo, thanks so much. That's Chief of Infectious Disease at the Jacobs School of Medicine, Dr. Tom Russo.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it, with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.